What is going on, everybody? Welcome to the 440 Guitar Podcast. I am your host, Jarrell Powell. Thank you so much for tuning up. You can guess the podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and anchor.fm/440. You can follow the podcast as well on Spotify or just whatever application that you prefer to do it. Well, but follow the podcast on Instagram is what I mean. I have the podcast on Instagram, so be sure to follow that. Get updated on the episodes from when they release. You can even message me on there if you have a question, if you know of an artist, you're like, hey, Jarrell should speak with that person. You can message me directly on Instagram. And I think you can still message me on podcasters for Spotify. Used to be Anchor. They changed it up. But if anything, you can also email me at the440podcast @gmail.com. And today is a very special day here for the podcast because I have the absolute pleasure and blessing to speak with one of the guitar players that I definitely just hold high when it comes to one of my favorite players when I was learning guitar at the time, and then just being a guitar player in general. Super humbled to have Chris Duarte on the show. How are you doing, Chris?
Doing great, Jarrell. Thanks for having me on here, man. Really excited to talk with you.
Of course, of course, of course. Yeah, definitely excited to talk with you as well. How's the weather out? And I know you're in Texas, right?
Yeah, in Texas, it's actually starting to cool down. It's not like the usual 104, 108 right now, where it's just cooking. But it's like a nice, like in the low 90s right now. So it's doing just fine.
Okay.
Beautiful day today.
Oh, okay. Glad to hear it. Glad to hear it. Very cool. Excellent. Excellent. So here at the 440 Guitar Podcast, we're a big fan of origin stories, how people got to where they are today. And I tend to like to ask this question just to kind of set a palette for the conversation. Tell me about your earliest memory of music, if you can recall.
My earliest memory of music, of course, is me being like, I think I was 7 or 8 years old. We were living in D.C. at the time. My father had gotten a job with the government back then. And we lived right down the street from Walter Reed Hospital. We could actually see. This is when the Vietnam War was kind of winding down. I know I'm that old. The Vietnam War was winding down, and we could see the helicopters coming in, you know, at the Walter Reed Hospital. It was down the street from us. But anyway, Fiddler on the Roof was making its network debut back when we had three channels, you know, and public television on the UHF dial. And so there's that scene where the beginning of the movie where that fiddler's on the roof in silhouette, you know, sawing out that little line at the very beginning. And I just thought that it just made such a big impression on me. And I was like, I want to play. I want to do something with music. I want to play an instrument. So I wanted to play the violin, of course. And so when school started, we ran down, you know, we went down to our elementary school and I signed up for music. And they said, I want to play the violin. They said, no, we have too many violin players already. How about the clarinet? I said, okay. Went back to my mom, said, too many violin players. I got clarinet. My mom said, no, you're not playing the clarinet. She didn't want a clarinet.
She was against that.
Yeah. In fact, I think she was even knitting at the time when I told her, and she didn't even look up. No clarinet. So I was like, okay. But as I say, the seed had been planted. I wanted to do something with music. And so it wasn't till actually years later, till probably, you know, when we got in our early teens, and I was probably around 13 or 14, my brother had gotten a guitar. He had gotten this Takamine classical guitar. I was constantly picking it up and playing it. Instead of us fighting over the guitar, my mom said, fine, I'm just going to go buy you a guitar. So I went and got a steel string dreadnought F-140 is what I think it was, because it was ripped off from me later on in the days. We all have equipment taken from us and one time in our lives. I hope it doesn't happen to y'all.
Oh,
out there,
man. I sure hope not.
It happens to us one time in our lives, whether it be something as innocuous as a pedal or some picks. But anyway, it was ripped off. But anyway, it was the Takamine F-140, and that's what I learned to play on. And instead of me putting bronze strings on it, I put electric strings on, nickel strings, so I could bend the strings and stuff for playing leads. And that's when I, you know, really started to work at guitar and work at playing. So that was probably when I was close to 15 years old, right around 15 years old.
Wow. Now, tell me, as far as like in the house, was there music played in the house? As I know you talked about Fiddler on the Roof, or that type of music. Were there like blues records or anything playing in the house?
No,
as well?
My mom actually was a big, like, my mom was actually a Joan Baez fan and a Bob Dylan fan. But the music we mainly heard is my mom was really into the country music that was around in the 70s and stuff. Hmm. So we heard a lot of that around. That's what she liked. And of course, when the outlaw scene started, Waylon and Willie. You know, we heard a lot of them. My mom dragged us down to, like, I don't know how many Willie Nelson shows we went to, probably four or five. Nice. Back in the day. But I mean, I loved them. I loved all those shows we went to. And I remember I went to a show when Dolly Parton was on. I saw Dolly Parton a long time ago. But yeah, I mean, that was mainly the music that was played around the house. And of course, when we were able to get our own music, first music I ever got from my first record was the Hey Jude album by Beatles. Back in the day. But yeah, of course I was a Beatles fan back when I was young. And then my sister was a Jackson 5 fan, and we just sort of had our own thing, you know, Beatles. And then later growing up, we started listening to AM radio as we did back in the day. And then we graduated to FM radio, the rock station in San Antonio, Kiss FM. And we started listening to more rock stuff. And this is probably back in my eighth grade, somewhere around there. And that's mainly what we listened to. And then it was, you know, close to my ninth or 10th grade is when I got the guitar.
Man. And then as far as like the blues in general, were there any particular artists that as you were going through that transition, listening to music, you know, on the radio, kind of more rock influence type stuff or blues influence type stuff? When did you first really get accustomed to the blues?
Blues music really didn't come along in my life real blues music, until I moved to Austin. I had left high school. I was starting to be a bad boy in high school, and I had started to skip school a lot. And then my mom was actually, we were moving. We were going to go live with our father up in the DC area, but I didn't want to go. And I was like 16 at the time, and I decided to go live with a friend of mine in Austin. So I moved to Austin at the age of 16. I was just barely almost 17, just a couple months away from being 17. So I moved up to Austin. But I mean, the blues to me, being from San Antonio, that was pretty much a heavy metal town. So it was mainly like, you know, the Jack by AC/DC or Since I've Been Loving You, you know, or I remember the Cream live album, Sleepy Time Blues. Great song, actually. I still love that song. I didn't start listening to real Muddy Waters and stuff till I got to Austin, Texas, and started to really get immersed in that. And that's when I got in a blues band. And at first, I mean, when the guys started teaching me, when I started playing, it was obvious I really couldn't play that music, that style, very well. And so my boss, Bobby Mack, who I first joined when I was almost 18, I was still 17, I joined Bobby Mack, and he told me to start picking out. So he started giving me solos, like Freddie King solos and Muddy Waters solos, the cats that were playing with Muddy Waters and Hubert Sumlin solos, to learn note for note, you know, to sort of give me a good foundation of how to sort of play the music. And that's, you know, that's when I realized I couldn't play the music and I better start working on it. So I started to really work at it and get to it. And that's when I just really started to fall in love with it.
That's really interesting, because one of the things that I admire about you as an artist is, and specifically with your playing, there's such a really powerful like emotion when you're playing, you know, and you really feel that through, you know, you playing leads or whatnot and playing, you know, and doing your solos and whatnot. But it's such a really powerful, expressive, really exciting thing to watch and to experience you playing live. You know, I feel like, you know, I feel like when it comes to music, like, it's just like seeing it live is really kind of that is the forefront of, you know, why anybody does what they do. Like, just to have that music be live in general and seeing you play is like, I mean, I haven't had the liberty to see you play live in person, but just seeing videos and seeing how you respond and playing live, very exciting. And that's one of the things that kind of like attracted me to your playing. I was like, oh man, like I really love how this, like, just like how you're bending the strings. Reminds me a little bit of like some Eric Clapton type, like how you're bending and things like that. So, and even just how that energy is transcribed or just carried over to your recordings too. You know, I think that's really impressive as well, because I think there's some blues artists where they sound great live, but that same type of energy is different on the record, you know, and I feel like you have a really powerful essence of kind of having those energies also in the recordings too. So just to kind of let you know, just huge fan of that in particular, you know, with your playing. So you saying that, like, you know, it, as far as you had to, the note for note working on it, you know, when you first were learning blues, surprising, but just because it's so natural and powerful now. Obviously you've been playing forever, but yeah, just wanted to say that to you.
You know, I mean, what it is, I mean, even though when I was learning the stuff note for note, what got me excited is when I was playing along with the records back then and I was matching up to the sounds, and it was like, oh man, I'm playing that. I can actually start to feel what's coming through the way I feel when I listen to this music. And that's what happens to me when I start playing some of that stuff. And when I'm learning like Coltrane solos and stuff, it freaks me out when I'm actually playing those same notes that he's doing, and it just sort of transports me. And that's when I just throw everything into it. So what I've done also is now when I play my own style, it's like, you know, you have to feel every note when you play, you know, get that commitment. You have to commit to the music. I mean, there are some nights where we just go through the motions and we play patterns and, you know, this part comes up, we play parts and patterns and stuff. But those are the nights I try to stay away from. I try to be open and free with improvisation and try to give people how I feel, just a window of my soul, how I'm going to feel that night. And the next night, it's going to be a little different. I might be telling the same kind of stories, but it's going to be just a little different. And that's why I really have a lot of people that follow me. They follow me, you know, 3, 4, 5, sometimes 10 shows in a row when I'm on a tour, because they want to see, well, what's he going to do next? What's going to happen next? And I think that is a big compliment. It's just, that's my main selling point, you know, and I think that's what came across in Texas Sugar was the emotion that we had with the album.
Yeah. I mean, and even too, you know, talking about your album that you recently released, you know, Ain't Giving Up, you know, definitely, I really like that album too. You know, that's really nice, great songs on there. I think Can Opener is probably my favorite. That's probably my favorite track.
Boy, that's an old song too. It's a really old one. It was funny how I kind of resurrected that one, but yeah, it's just us playing, you know, just the shuffle, just going over in the key of A, actually concert G, but it's key of A for me. And I mean, I'm just, you know, what we did is every night when you're doing that session, we would play that song one time at the end of the night, and just to see if we can come up with one version that we can keep with the most minimal of edits, you know. And that's the one we came up, and that's the way Dennis's MOD is, you know. He wants the key, keeps everything when we record. And that's the one thing I had forgotten, because I had worked with Mike Varney for so long, you know, and Mike Varney, we do it kind of like the traditional way. You know, you get your bass and drum tracks first, and then if you can get a guitar solo here and there or get a guitar rhythm, great. But you know, you're going to come back, you're going to redo all the guitar parts, and then you'll do the vocals. And that's the way I'd gotten used to playing, because Dennis is really, he wants to capture that that organic feel when we're playing. And that's what I like about working with Dennis.
Really neat. Was there any typical, was there, as far as like the placement of when you were recording, was it just in like a traditional studio and just like how the, like, was there a certain way that he mic'd everything as far as like the amps and whatnot, just to kind of get that authentic sound?
You know, I mean, Dennis, man, Dennis is, you know, it was funny because I had worked with Dennis in Texas Sugar, that's back in 94. And then I worked with him in 2000 for the Romp album, and now here it is, like almost 20 years, 20 some odd years later, 21 years later, you know, I work with him again, and his, just his perspective and his way of his craft of recording is just, it's just so spot on. He learned so much. No, it was just this studio kind of in Northern California. It was north of LA. I think it was just a little bit further north of Tarzania or whatever that town's name
is. It was
further up there. Well, it was a Plier studio is what it was. Mm. And it just had great old equipment. It's got a huge Neve board, an A-class Neve board in there. And I love that stuff. And he's got a bunch of old mics. But yeah, I mean, I would tell him too. I'd say, you know, let's get that room sound. I love the room sound of an amp. Put the amp back there and then putting that mic way back away from the amplifier or the cabinet, you know, getting that lots of sound. But yeah, we were using like old mics and stuff. And I just used one amp the whole time, just one amp and one guitar for the whole session, which was kind of funny. You know, I hadn't done that in a long, long time since Texas Sugar.
Wow. And then of course I got to ask you about, well, actually, let me ask you a little more on the album. Just as far as to dig a little bit on the album. So, was a lot of that album that came out this year, a lot of that is just kind of old tracks compiled together, or was it kind of a bit of a combination as far as some stuff you wrote more recent and everything that was put together on the project?
The only old song on there was Can Opener, and all the other songs, I was helped by my girlfriend and muse, Beth Lee. She helped me write 7 of the songs on there. The title track was written by her.
Oh, nice.
And those were, you know, and those were new songs that I had written just like the previous 6 or 7 months before that. And yeah, it was all mainly new material.
That's great. So it sounds like it was pretty free flowing as far as those songs just, you know, being written and made. What would you say is the overall time frame of the album being complete in general? Is it kind of like a, you know, two years to write it or whatnot, or was it? It seemed like it came along pretty quickly as far as the duration.
Oh gosh, I mean, some of the songs might have been with Beth maybe about 6-7 months before the album, and then we got it all settled down. We knew Dennis was producing it, and we knew where we were going to record it, and it was just after that. It was 2 weeks. We had it all done 2 weeks, and the funny thing was I was still in that mode of thinking we were going to come back and do guitar parts. And so when we were going to do vocals, we were doing vocals like 3 months later. I think we recorded in September, and then December I came back to LA and I instinctively grabbed a guitar and I walked in. We were doing vocals on another studio and I walked in with my guitar and I don't see any amps or any guitar room, just a soundboard and a vocal booth. I was like, we're going to do guitar, right? And he goes, oh, no, guitars are done. And I just thought that was just crazy because I wasn't in that mode when it came time to do solos. I was like, okay, just fill it up here, loosey-goosey, whatever, you know. But it all worked because I told them, let me listen to it. And, you know, it all worked. I was like, I can live with that. It sounds great. And it was like I sort of hit myself in the head, like, what was I thinking? This is how Dennis works. And that's why I think the album sounds so great.
I think it's also a testament to how you guys trust each other from an artistic standpoint, you know, where he's like, oh no, guitars are done. Like what you did, that was it. You know what I mean? And
right.
him having that ear for that, you know, and you're like, oh, okay. You know what I mean? And they listen to it and you're like, yeah, you're right. You know what I mean? So I think that's definitely a testament to your guys.
You're right, Jarrell, because I really do trust Dennis. Dennis got it great. I mean, it's just all the years he's got, and he just still keeps his finger on the pulse. He's not like a guy that's stuck in a certain age of music. No, he's right up there current with everything that's going on, all kinds of music. So he's a pretty amazing guy. So it's a lot of fun working with him.
Awesome. Awesome. So talk to me about your equipment, right? So, I mean, I guess we can start with the guitar. You know, I see a lot of the times you, you had that exotic, that gold, the gold Strat, exotic guitar. How did you get accustomed to, playing, on an exotic guitar? When did that come about?
What happened is my 63 was really starting to wear down. I had worn the frets down, and I'd usually have to get it refretted every other year because I would wear the frets down because we play such long. We played so many gigs. I was always playing between 100 and 150 gigs on the road, not to mention all the wow. gigs I do around town. So I was doing a lot of that stuff on the road. And so I'd wear those frets down. And you know, when you do that, you have to file the fretboard down. And so there's just this thin veneer of rosewood left. And I could have had another slab put on it, but I wanted to keep that guitar as original as possible to pass on to my daughter. So I was cool. getting it reproduced by Fender, you know, the way they can do those laser measurements and remake it. And so I had gone to Fender out in Scottsdale or wherever their custom shop is out by Phoenix. And we were starting to add it up, and they had said, oh, that'll be $7,000. I was like, wait a minute, guys, that's the price for the guy from off the street. I said, I don't mind paying. That's okay if I pay a couple thousand. I don't want a free guitar from you guys, but I'll pay a couple thousand. I'll pay for, you know, all the materials and stuff and a little bit for the work. But I can't afford a $7,000 or $8,000 guitar. And so they sort of drag their feet, not to be bad on Fender. Fender has just got a lot of people interested in Fender, and you have to really be at a certain level to really get their attention. And I understand that's just business. That's just the way it goes. So Exotic kind of stepped in and they wanted to sponsor me. And I said, well, if you can copy my 63, copy the neck exactly like it is, because I didn't want my hand getting used to another neck. They said they can do that. So that's what they did. I had measurements of the neck of the 63. They made me a guitar, and I told them first they had given me like this ice blue sort of one. And I played that for a long time. And then they were giving me another one. And I said, I've always loved the gold sparkle. So I tell them, make me a gold sparkle one and make the headstock the same color, and we're good to go. And so Exotic's been taking care of me really well for the last 19 years. And they're made there in LA, you know, out in Ventura. And they're a really good company, and I like them a lot. And so they take real good care of me. Nice. So I can make anything work, really, but Exotic takes real good care of me. And that's why I've been an Exotic man for the last 10 years.
That's great. That's great. Yeah, that gold sparkle definitely has that Texas vibe to it too, right?
Yeah, it's their pickups. It's Exotic pickups in there. Okay. It's got a real good response to it. And plus, you know, with my ear, I can go to almost any amp and make it work, you know, sort of adjust the knobs and make anything kind of work. I mean, that's just something you learn over the years. As long as I've been playing, you know, you learn how to get what you want out of what you're handed.
Definitely. And then for the pickups, do you know, I know they're there. Is it the Raw Vintage 50s, or do you know in particular the...
I believe they are the Raw Vintage. I don't know okay. if they're the Raw Vintage 50s, but I think they are. And yeah. of course, I use some of their other, I use the titanium bridges okay. on there and stuff like that. Yeah. And yeah, they've got all their electronics and stuff in it. Nothing really special in it. I'm nice. Pretty much a basic guy. I don't know a lot of the technical terms. That's something I never really learned a lot of. I was more of a guy that was like, you know, how do you get what you need out of an amp? What is this pedal like? What can you do with this pedal? I just never delved into like the real technical aspects of sure. things. I just didn't have a head for that. I've just been pretty much a dumbbell about that stuff.
And those are some of the best players, man. I remember talking to Jairus Mosey. He was like, I'm just a guitar to amp guy. he's like, you know, I'm not super technical out of it, you know, it's like amazing players. It's like, hey, you focus on the right stuff, you know. So nothing.
Right. You know, I just concentrate on playing and stuff, but there's nothing wrong with learning your equipment, man. A lot sure. of guys made, I mean, look what Tom Scholz did, you know. Well, he was from MIT and electronics and stuff, so yeah. Mm.
I would imagine too, you know, with that gold top, since you've had it for so long, I would imagine since you've played it so much, you probably have, like, I'm assuming, like, stainless steel frets or something. So as far as, you probably don't need to get it refiled as much as probably your old Fender, right?
No, I put nickel frets. You know, steel, for some reason, stainless steel, they just have this certain, I do have one guitar that has stainless steel. They just have this real metallic, too much of a metallic quality. I can hear it in the sound. And I've always been used to the nickel sound. So, I mean, I don't want to say my hearing's that acute, but I mean, for some reason I can notice the difference with the stainless steel frets.
Yeah.
So, but I mean, I know the advantage of stainless steel frets. They hardly wear down, you know, you don't have to get them crowned and stuff. But you know, I like nickel, man. It just seems to be more soft. It has a better response with me.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I like nickel too. I mean, I haven't been around stainless steel frets until recently because of technology. It's like now people can buy stainless steel fret and guitars for like $400. And like that was like not possible years ago, you know. So I've been used to nickel myself, so that makes sense. And then I know you're not super technical on like the wiring and all that stuff, but I was curious about what type of overdrive you like using, or is it more so like really pushing the amp when it comes to your, you know, your playing?
No, I mean, you know, I mean, I'm not at that level where I can get out and play really loud at a lot of clubs. I mean, there's some festivals I can go to where I can really open up the amp and stuff. But mainly since I'm stuck in clubs and not great big clubs anymore. So I have to really learn to play at lower volumes and learn how to work with that. So I use like a lot of, the pedal I mainly use is these pedals from Pedal Diggers out of Kobe, Japan. They've given me these pedals called the 808 pedals, and they gave me three different ones. And the big one's got like a bunch of old electronics in it, NOS, new old stock, I think is what they used in it. And then the second one's a smaller one. And it's the smaller they get, the crazier the distortion on it. Wow. And I actually use all three of them, but I have them stacked up where I mainly use the big one the most. Sometimes it's just a little bit of a boost for low volume, and I'll use the middle pedal to use my lead solos. Or if I've got the guitar, I mean, the amp loud enough, I'll just only use the big pedal, and I hardly ever have to touch the third pedal, the little one. But wow. Yeah, they're Pedal Diggers out of Kobe, Japan. They've been 808 pedals.
That's cool, man. I'll have to check them out. It's funny. I just came back from Japan like last week. I was there for 9 days. So, man, yeah, I'll have to write that down. Yeah, because your tone is so rich, you know, with that, with those tones and those pedals. So, I mean, they know what they're doing. You know what I mean? And I didn't know you were stacking like that much too. So I was like, wow, like that's really a testament to their, you know, their stuff. Obviously it's Japan, but
Right. I mean, it's just the way it works. Yeah. Cause I can get just real subtle, you know, boosts with the first one. And then when I turn on the second one, you know, it's not crazy. I just give it nice warm tones. And then the third one is just like all crazy, get out, go for it, Hendrix style, you know, distortion and stuff. But yeah, it works real well. I like the pedals a lot.
Very cool. And what's your go-to amp? Anything in particular?
The one I'm using right now is I'm using a Fender Vibro King. I've been using that one. It's the first year they made them. Serial number on it's 0068. And then some Fender guy told me 60 was the first to public. I don't know. That's what I've just been told. But so I've been using that for a while. I just sort of resurrected this. So I've been using that a lot for about the last 3 years. I've been using that amp a lot. I've got another one. I've got a Chicago Blues Box, which is pretty much modeled after the old 50s Bassman, the Tweed Bassman. And that one really works good. I just used it on a couple gigs. lately, and I was like, you know, I really like the sound of this amp. So I started using that just the last couple gigs. But the Fender Vibra King seems to get what I need. If I need Hendrix tones, I can get it out of that.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, if I can drag out my Marshall, I have an old 73 JMP 50-watt head that I can drag out, a red one with a matching red cabinet. I love dragging that thing out because it looks so good. But, yeah, I mean, but it's very rare I get to drag out the Marshall. But then I have a bunch of amps, you know, but it just depends. Sometimes I go through phases. It's, you know, amp du jour. It's like whatever I'm using at the time. For a while there, I was using Randall amps. And then I was using, I had my old Fender 75 that I was using for a while. But like I said, lately it's my go-to's been the Vibra King.
Very cool. Very cool. Man, that's really exciting. Yeah, because I would imagine I'm assuming the Vibra King doesn't give you a nice kind of headroom when you're playing it live. Because I'm assuming too, it must be great to use too, especially if you're not able to play at such like high volumes, but it still kind of gives you that, you know, the sound that's required, or the sound that you like, you know, out of it as well. So it seems like it's a pretty versatile amp, would you say?
Yeah, I think it is, because I mean, I can get kind of clean tones on it when I kind of lower it down. I lower the volume down, because mainly, I mean, once I get past, if I get up to 3, you know, then it starts getting really dirty. Then I don't even have to use a box to boost the rhythm sounds, because then it starts getting dirty. When I get around 4 or 5, then the amp's really dirty. And I miss hearing all the strings. It gets a little too crunchy for me for playing blues. But I mean, I like the amp a lot. And usually I'm like it right at about 2, you know, is where I play, you know, in a lot of clubs. If I can get a little over 2, then it's great, you know. Nice. But I can deal with it just fine at 2, you know. But it you turn that fat switch on and it makes a world of difference. But yeah, it's got, you know, when everything works on it, because a lot of times the reverb's notoriously bad for shorting out on it. Also, the tremolo, you know, goes out a lot, you know, but it stays good on the main part. But I've got all the features working on it right now, because I got it all worked on before the tour started up in May. So yeah, the amp gets a lot of colors for me.
Nice. Very cool. Yeah, I was watching some YouTube videos. I think it was, I think I want to say when I was watching you on YouTube, that it was someone recorded a really fantastic video of you, very clear. And I want to say it might have been around May of this year or whatnot. And I think, I don't know if it was a festival, because I saw Philip Seitz was on the same stage.
Yeah, car show. I'm using am I playing the Hamilton?
I think so.
That's from Dallas. That was May. That was before I started, before the tour started. That was like early May this year. Yeah, I know the recording. Yeah, it actually sounded real good. Yeah, Philip Seitz was on that show. It was good. It was good to finally meet him, because I'd heard about him for so long. But yeah, unfortunately, a long time ago, I had snapped off the headstock of the Hamilton, like long time ago. I mean, back when I didn't even have it for a couple of years. So I got that guitar back in 95. And so it got fixed. And for the longest time, I didn't play that guitar. And then I thought, well, you know, people really love this guitar. You know, they just love it when I pull it out. And it's like, it's a real Hamilton, since it was made by Jim, because now somebody's bought the company and they're making Hamiltons right now, but they're not real Hamiltons made by Jim Hamilton.
Yeah.
So I started bringing that guitar out again. So I think the glue job that was done on the headstock, I think since it was so old, and taking the strings off, because I change strings every night, and taking the strings off, putting them back on, taking them off, putting them back on, I think that did something to the joint. And then I was in Cleveland, and then boom, it just popped off, you know, as I was putting strings on. Damn. So I dropped it off somewhere. I'm not worried about it, because people can do magical things with guitars. Luthiers are magicians now with wood. Yeah. So it'll be fixed. It'll be back. But yeah, I just had to leave it with somebody to get fixed. But yeah, it was a lot of fun playing that thing, even though it was a different kind of neck on that. It feels like a Les Paul, because it's kind of a wide, flat neck, and it's like an ebony, almost like an ebony fingerboard on that thing with the binding on it too. But you know, I've gotten used to it, and it's a nice guitar, and it's got those Rio Grande pickups in it. Who made those? Rock and Rob Rio Grande pickups. The real old ones, of course, yeah. From the 90s and stuff.
Wow. Wow. That's so neat. That's so neat.
I love the awe factor when you pull it out. Everybody goes, oh. I haven't had my 63 for so long, and you get used to that awe factor when you pull a 63 out. But it's, you know, it was, the awe factor was back pulling that thing out. And people just love that guitar. They just love, like, looking at it. Lots of times I wouldn't even play it. I'd just leave it there on the stage. People would just be, you know, not even looking at me, looking at the guitar. You know. Go ahead, you know.
When's he going to pick it up?
Right, exactly.
Oh, man. Is it a heavy guitar, too? Because I would imagine.
Yeah, it is kind of heavy. It's a little bit heavier. And the one unusual thing is it does have a cutaway in it, like a Strat does. Mm. And Jim had told me Stevie always wanted a cutaway in his, but he never got one because he said his always hit his ribs and stuff. But, yeah, it's a little bit heavier, but it's a really nice guitar.
Nice. Very nice. Are there any favorite songs that you like playing live these days as far as when you're touring and whatnot? You know, are there any particular songs that just kind of, you know, hold a little closer to you versus others?
You know, I still love, you know, the songs have evolved so much over the years. You know, they don't sound anything like the original recordings anymore. I mean, it's funny when I listen to the original recordings, I'm like, oh, yeah, I forgot I did that part in that song. Oh, yeah, it went like that, you know, right there. I mean, I'm still playing My Way Down. You got to play the big hit. You know, I'll be cursed to play that song, but I'm glad it's a fun song to play. And then, of course, I do an outro solo on it now, and rather than opposed to the breaking down. Well, not breaking down, but, you know, it goes out, you know, pretty much just two times, and then you're out on the album. I do like playing People Say a lot because we do this, like, big outro sort of jam thing at the end to build it up, you know, gradually just build it up to a crazy crescendo. I do like playing the song that's on my Lucky 13 album, Minefield of the Mind, because that was a song that I had just written pretty much for that session, and I wasn't used to going in and out the chords that I am now, because I've been playing it for so long. I'm much better at getting around those chords. And so that's a lot of fun to play. But that's like a real demanding song with the drummer. So it takes a special drummer to really pull that song off, because I just can't play that with any drummer, because it really takes a certain level of talent. And I'm real fortunate. Tom Breckline lives here in Austin, Texas, and I get to play with him a lot. Mm. And so playing with him, I mean, it's like skating on ice playing with him. His meter is so good. But yeah, I mean, that song I like a lot, and I still like the new songs a lot. I like Ain't Giving Up a whole bunch. I like Come My Way a bunch. I haven't really incorporated Big Fight yet in the sets, but I do all the other songs. I do every other song. Weekday's a lot of fun. And of course, Can Opener is like the very opening song of my shows right now. Cause like what I've learned from Stevie after listening to a lot of Stevie bootlegs is Stevie would always come out and give you an uppercut with an instrumental. You know, that's how we'd start his shows off. And then you do then you come in with the vocals after that. So, I mean, I love playing Can Opener. It's a lot of fun. Yeah. And there's different ways I can approach it. You know, it just depends how I'm feeling that day. Some days I'll pretty much stick to the script, you know, and do like a show. Or some days it'll just be loose and I'll just start really going off on crazy wild tangents. and that's when my band's really got to be on their toes, because I don't know what direction I'm going to take the music, you know. But I'm glad I have a good band, and those guys are good followers. The band I have on the road, they do a good job, and I love playing with my musicians here in Austin.
Yeah. That's great too, that you have a band that is able to be versatile and okay, let's see where it goes and we can follow you. You know what I mean? I think that kind of creates this a fun experience with those same people that, you know, they'll follow you 10 shows or whatnot. Cause it's like, depending on how you go and how the band responds to it, it's like, yeah, like you're not going to get this on a record. It's like, I gotta go.
Right. Exactly.
It.
they're just, it's going to be something different, you know, and that's, they love it. And then you can even see it on the YouTube videos. If they have like a shot of the whole band, you could see they're kind of watching me, you know, to where I'm going to go. And, you know, that's why I like it. And that's what a lot of people tell me. They said, you should just see your musician just watching you the whole time. Well, I hope so. You know,
bass player just staring at Chaz.
Right.
Where's it going to go? Drummer's like, all right, here we go.
Exactly. But very, I mean, cool. That's, you know, I just love getting out and playing on the road and getting to see people and, you know, being able to do, every day is different, even though it's still the same, wake up, drive, get to the gig, load in. When the gig starts, it's all different, you know, and that's what I live for is, you know, just to create, have those few hours to create and to move people. You know, that's what I love doing.
Awesome. Is there a story behind the title of the album? I know you said your girlfriend titled the album Ain't Giving Up. Is there a story behind that? You know, because
I think it just, I mean, that was a song. It's, you know, it's just about relationships. That's what she wrote it for. But I think it's about, because I hadn't released an album like in 5 or 6 years. And I think a lot of people were like, you know, what's happened with Chris? What's going on? You know, is he still doing anything? What's going on? And I think it just sort of went apropos with the way I was feeling when the album came up, that I wanted to tell people I'm back. I haven't given up. You know, I'm still here playing. And that's pretty much it. You know, I just thought it just went with the vibe so much. So I thought it was a great way to use the title cut and also the sort of the name for the album.
That's interesting. Yeah, because it's funny, too, because I remember when it popped up in my algorithms on Spotify. I was like, oh, snap, he's got a new album out, you know, but I didn't even think about as far as the time when you didn't release anything, just because when I would think of Chris Duarte, I would think of just these solos that like inspired me. So just like, I'm sure he's still doing something, you know, like, yeah, but I didn't have a worry in my brain. And then when I saw the album, I was like, oh, cool. Okay. Yeah. So that affirms like, yeah, he's still, you know, still releasing music.
Yeah, I was glad to get another product out, and I'm, you know, I'm real happy with my record company. It feels good. I mean, although working with Mike Varney was a dream, because Mike Varney is just, he's a legend in the industry. You can connect him with, you know, 2 degrees of separation from anybody in the music industry of any sort of form of music. Mike Varney, he's a walking encyclopedia, and he's a great guy, extremely sharp, a lot of fun to be with. But, you know, but they didn't have like the big, they weren't a big record company. And being with Pro Vogue under the Mascot umbrella is like being with a nice record company. They got their PR department. They have their art department. It's really nice. It feels good. So, and then, you know, they got me on a new agency. I'm with Worldwide Artists out of LA. So, and Chuck's been doing a great job. Chuck Benarl and his assistant Lorraine, they've been doing a great job. So I'm real happy with what it's given me right now. So I'm looking forward to the next 2 years of my life.
Very cool. Very exciting. Very exciting. Man, well, I was going to ask you one last thing as far as, you know, how do you feel about blues music today in 2023? Do you still feel like it's still alive and well? You know, because it's funny, sometimes I find myself playing, I remember I was at a show a long time ago, was playing blues music, and like some of the responses were like, oh man, yeah, it's playing that old school music, you know, and like I'm thinking that it's like everyday music, because that's like, I listen to a lot of that, that's a lot of my inspiration. Do you feel that it's still kind of healthy, alive, and well with some of these players that are coming in and, you know, playing blues? How do you feel about that?
You know, if I really should get out and listen to more of the cats. For some reason, I just kind of got, I probably got a little jaded because I thought it was sort of going in this one direction. It was doing more of the blues rock sort of idiom. Was kind of like, I wasn't too excited what was going on in the blues rock idiom. And I really didn't hear a lot of people pushing the envelope. I mean, there's good players out there. No doubt they're great players. But as far as getting me real excited, I wasn't too excited. But I mean, that's not to diminish their talents. All these people are really good players.
Yeah.
I mean, the same could be said for me. For a while there, I was in a really bad funk. I was putting out pretty average music there for a while, I think. But I think it's, I mean, when I see the publications that are still out, it's obviously alive and things are moving and there's still a lot of money in there. There's still a lot of support for it. I do feel somebody needs to come along and really wake up a younger generation because it seems like the audiences are getting older and older and we're not getting a lot more of the younger crowds out. And it's, I mean, maybe when the people get into their 30s and 40s and they, it's like everything runs in cycles. You come back to blues rock, you know, and get in your older years. I don't know, maybe. Yeah. But I just see my audience, you know, unfortunately, I've seen my audience, a lot of them kind of, you know, pass on into the other side and stuff. And I'm seeing less and less of the young people out. I mean, Gary Clark was really doing some great things. Yeah. I thought Gary Clark was doing a lot of cool influences, bringing in a lot of things. I really like what Gary Clark's doing.
Yeah.
But I think I really, to give an honest evaluation of how blues rock is doing or how blues music itself is doing, I probably should delve into it to be more knowledgeable before I really speak up. But I mean, as far as cats like, you know, Wolf and Muddy and, you know, Buddy and, you know, all those cats, you know, they're, you know, we're not going to get cats like that anymore, you know, unfortunately. I mean, it's like all the bop guys, you know, bop is gone. I mean, sure, there's some bop guys out there, but, you know, like the real old bop guys, or, you know, that, or the 60s jazz, all that stuff, it's kind of gone. So I don't know, you know, I'm really waiting for somebody to wake up and bring in more influences, modern influences into it, but still keep the tradition alive. I know that sounds like I'm speaking out of both sides of my mouth, but I don't know. It's just something. I think it's there. I'm just waiting. I guess waiting for the Messiah to come along.
And yeah,
we haven't seen. There's a lot of good people out there. A lot of good players out there, no doubt. But I guess right now, there's nobody out there that really excites me, and that includes me. I'm not even exciting myself. I'm trying to do something. I'm trying to be good out there, but I'm really appreciative for the people that think I'm doing something.
Yeah, I would say so, definitely. No, and I appreciate your honesty, too, because I feel like, I think besides, like, you, like, I feel like Kingfish.
Yeah, like, Christopher's doing really good, man.
Yeah, yeah, like, he's, because I think he's, I want to say he's in his maybe late 20s or early 30s, but his phrasing is outstanding. You know, really just kind of breathes life with some of those older players. But I do agree with you. I think, you know, I would love to see the future where there are some more younger folks, you know, because I feel like, and you know, I think you are right too, as far as like every now and again, it's, we kind of get like, oh, like this is popular again, like 80s music, like is like popular again in a sense with a lot of these artists, the pop artists. You know, so like, yeah, I would like for the blues to be something where you have a wider range, you know, of audiences going to see that. So I think we'll get a second coming soon.
I'm really hoping, you know, I hope so. I mean, I did see it. I saw it like, you know, when Stevie burst out. Actually, I mean, I remember when that Muddy Waters album came out in the late 70s, you know, with Johnny Winter produced that, Manish Boy on it. That was a huge record back in the late 70s. I remember it, man. That's when he was opening up for Clapton on the road and stuff. That was crazy, you know. But you know, and then it came back around when Stevie came out, and then we had God, what's his name? Kevin. I can't believe he was just playing. Oh, well, a big player, but yeah, a lot of cats. It was cyclical, so maybe he'll come back around. There are a lot of good young players out there, but for some reason, it's just not really exciting me. Kingfish is doing real good, though. I'm really happy to see he's doing good. Really good player, man. Cat can play, man.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Lastly, you know, is there anything that you wanted to plug or kind of share some information with your fans as far as like the next gig that folks should be ready for or, you know, looking forward to or anything like that?
Gosh, well, I haven't got a tour booked yet. That's why you see this growth on my face. Normally, I'm clean shaven, but I've just been off the road for a while. It's funny because when I'm on the road, it's like I'm on the job 24 hours a day, you know, because I'm driving the van, you know, I'm taking care of my guys, I'm booking the hotels. Although I have somebody book the gigs and stuff, it's like that's when I get off the road. It's like, you know, I don't have to post every day on social media. I don't ever do this.
Right.
I just kind of go in my shell and just kind of, you know, just escape for a while. Just be me. But I'm ready to come back out. I've been writing new songs for the album. And cool. So I'm hoping to get in the studio sometime next year because I know they want to do another album. I know we're going to start some tours up in March. I'm trying to get together a tour for this late year before the year comes out because I know there's some clubs up in the Northeast that still want me one more time this year. So I'm trying to do that. And, you know, no, it's just I still practice, still try to practice every day, still try to do new ideas. I want to try to learn more Coltrane solos. I haven't done that in a long time. Work on that stuff because it gives me ideas and stuff. And then try to, you know, just keep opening my ideas and try to stay present in the moment and when I'm playing and try to play from the heart every time I play, you know, and try to think of new ideas to come up because I just want to keep getting better and keep advancing. Find another way to get from point A to point B. And I really want to thank you, Jarrell, for having me on here. And I want to thank everybody at 440 Podcast that subscribes to this place and keeping Jarrell going, too, and everything going. And
I appreciate
that's
that.
Just it, man. What were you over in Japan for? I meant to ask that.
So I was my mother-in-law initially just asked, like, hey, like, I'm going to be going to Japan. Like, do you guys want to go? And we were just like, yeah, like we just said yes, like even before figuring out how to get there financially, we were just like, yes, you know what I mean? So she got the tickets and then we just kind of went, we were just saving up and everything as much as we could to go. So we were there for 9 days, but I've always wanted to go because I've always had an affinity for Japan, even from just like my old days working at a GameStop and whatnot, and then just technology in general, pedals and, you know, everything, right? So yeah, so that's why I was out there, and I ended up getting a guitar out there. Bought a guitar in Kyoto, this old like Les Paul photogenic, it's kind of like an Epiphone custom copy guitar, but it was like, the guy gave it to me for a discount for like 9,000 yen, which is like $67 in USD money. Yeah. So I was like, okay. I said, that's coming to the US. So I ended up buying a case out there and checked the thing in for like $40 or whatever. And said, yeah, this is coming over here. I'm not shipping this over.
So you went to Kyoto. Where else did you go? Did you go to like the usual Tokyo, Osaka?
Yeah, Osaka, Akasaka, Shinjuku, around Tokyo, Narita. Kyoto is my favorite, but we went to quite a few cities. So
yeah, Kyoto's nice, man. Did you make it to any clubs? Did you see any people play or anything like that?
Not yet. And that's a funny thing. It's like, that's like the, when I do go back, cause I think when I do end up going back, I think that's going to be the next step is the live music portion, getting some clubs, seeing live music. My wife, her cousin lives in Japan and they were like singing in a karaoke bar drinking till 3 a.m. So they had a great time. But
exactly. I was married to a Japanese woman for like 10 years. And so I can kind of speak it. I can kind of read it. I can get around. When I started to learn how to speak it and read it and write it, that's when the world kind of really opened up to me over in Japan. So I've been over there a bunch. So I know it real well over there. So I was real interested when you said that. Did you get, there's my favorite ramen place, the Tenkai Ippin ramen place. I love that place. I can eat there every day. It's just this place. It's like a chain sort of place, but it's got this big red spot. Tenkai Ippin. There's a bunch of, you probably saw some.
Probably saw something. It's funny because I had something that I thought was ramen, but it was tanden. It was a Taiwanese place, but it was still great.
Yeah. I mean, they've got all great food. You can eat something different for 2 weeks. You can eat something different every single course. I mean, don't they have a lot of convenience stores over there? Is that crazy?
Yeah. Even the 7-Elevens blow my mind.
The Lawson. Yeah, way they tell you hello, and you you walk in. I love it, man. I would move over there in a heartbeat. And I would live in Osaka. That's the town. Nice. My ex-wife was from Osaka, so I got to know the dialect I have is an Osaka dialect.
Oh,
so,
cool.
Yeah, I love Osaka. Osaka's a great town, man.
Very cool. Very cool.
Well, that's it, man. You got to do that, man. That's great.
appreciate it.
Yeah,
well,
man.
Well, Chris Duarte, again, thank you so much for being on the show, man. Definitely appreciate it. Great honor of mine. Congrats on this album and then the next one that you're going to be cooking up here soon. And I know you got a lot of fans. You know, can't wait to see you play live again. So congrats on all that success.
Thank you so much, Jarrell, for having me on here. I love talking with you. Love just sitting here chatting, talking shop. And anytime, man, just, you know, you got my address. You know how to get a hold of me. Contact me for anything, man. Anytime, brother.
Appreciate it. Well, there you have it, folks. This is Jarrell from the 440 Guitar Podcast. We'll jam again soon, and have a good day. Give me your love.